Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know how part of the excuse for high oil prices has been tight supply? Well, get a load of this. The Iraqi oil ministry said today its production is actually going up. And at better than $115 a barrel, that means a bunch more money in Baghdad's bank accounts. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org. And by Clarkson Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is the 24th of April today, Thursday. Good to have you here. The promise from the Bush administration before the invasion was that Baghdad would be able to finance its own reconstruction. When he was number two at the Pentagon, Paul Wolfowitz said sales of oil revenues would do it. That hasn't been the case so far, but the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction says Iraq could net $70 billion in oil revenues this year, more than enough for Baghdad to begin paying its own way. Stuart Bowen is the Special Inspector General. Mr. Bowen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai. It's good to be with you.
It kind of makes sense in the face of these rising prices, but I thought they had serious production problems there, pipeline problems, export problems. Have those been solved?
They haven't been solved, but progress has been made. The pipeline to Turkey began to come online 6 months ago and is now exporting at a rate of about 300,000 barrels a day. That's a significant addition. Indeed, it accounts for most of the rise in the exports.
What are they doing with this money? Are they just sticking it in the bank someplace?
Well, the Iraqi oil revenues are deposited in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, pursuant to the previous agreement. But they are moving forward with a plan to execute another budget this summer to allocate the use of this new money.
Do you know if the Iraqi government has plans to spend some of this surplus on capital reinvestment in its oil pipelines and infrastructure?
Yes, that is what they report. And the oil minister has been extremely busy, as had the prime minister, moving forward with an expanded capital plan and with a new reconstruction planning.
This is obviously a politically sensitive issue back here, the prospect of Iraq having a surplus while we don't.
Well, I mean, my job is just to report on what we're finding over there. And what we're finding is that there is extraordinary potential for new investment by Iraq in their economy. Most critical is Iraq effectively executing its budgets. The country has simply had to relearn how to do that over the last few years. That needs to come up for the infrastructure really to revive.
Is this $70 billion enough for Iraq to at least partially fund its own reconstruction?
At least. And certainly Iraq is taking the lead in funding its own reconstruction, and it is the possessor of the third largest oil reserves in the world. It is a wealthy country, and it should, as its capacities develop, be able to begin to prosper.
Do you have any reason to believe that this trend won't continue? That is to say that their oil revenues won't keep on growing?
I don't have any reason to believe that. The post-invasion record outputs this quarter in oil production and oil exports, and prices are going up. I think that their income will go up as well.
Stuart Bowen is the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. Mr. Bowen, thanks for your time.
Kai, thank you. Good to be with you.
As it happens, Congress is chewing over a new supplemental spending request for Iraq and Afghanistan as we speak. The White House wants another $108 billion for continuing military operations. The president may well get it, but some lawmakers say it is past time for the U.S. to stop paying for Reconstruction. Nebraska Democrat Ben Nelson's one of them. Senator, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
What did you think when you saw this $70 billion number about Iraq oil's revenues?
It's obvious that there's a windfall that Iraq is experiencing, and it's at our expense. They're generating a surplus at a time, in large part, because of our defense and our work on their behalf, we're generating a deficit.
What would you have us do then, sir, with the money that we're spending on Iraq?
Well, I'm working with Senator Collins from Maine and Senator Bayh from Indiana to create a bill that would provide that any future reconstruction money, for example, in Iraq, would be in the form of a loan or direct payment by the Iraqi government. If we'd been able to get the administration to back off blocking the legislation in 03 that would require Iraq to take money in the form of loans as opposed to grants, if we'd done that, $45 billion that the U.S. government has spent for reconstruction would be an IOU to the United States.
What's your response to the argument, though, Senator, that in large part what's going on in Iraq is the responsibility of the United States? We should help them pay for it.
Well, we have, to the tune of $500 billion thus far. The question is how much and how fair is it for us to continue to pay largely all of it when we're generating a deficit at a time when they're generating surpluses that could go as high as $70 billion this year. And we're sitting with $25 to $30 billion of their money in banks in New York. So it's a matter of going back and asking the question, if they can pay their own way in this, why shouldn't they?
Would you be ready to vote against the president's $100 billion request for continuing operations in Iraq and Afghanistan if you don't get your way on this?
No, I don't know that I would. We're taking a belt and suspenders approach. We're going to get as much of this on the supplemental that we as we can. But it's also possible that it would come up again or alongside with the authorization bill of the defense budget. So we may have more than one bite at that apple.
Ben Nelson, Democratic senator from the state of Nebraska. Senator, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Kai. Good to talk to you.
In case you're curious, oil took a little dip today, down about $3 to $115 a barrel. That is still too steep, though, for the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Nancy Pelosi said today she wants President Bush to stop adding crude to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The government buys about 70,000 barrels a day for the reserve. Pelosi wants it out on the open market instead. On Wall Street today, tech led the way thanks to Apple and all those iPods it's selling. Financials did pretty well, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just in case you were unsure, here's another sign the American consumer is falling farther behind. Target said in filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission this week that it's had to write off a chunk of its outstanding credit card debt. Bad news for one of the country's biggest retailers. Worse for cardholders who are discovering they can't pay what they owe. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Consumers are getting squeezed as prices for gas and food move higher. As a result, more and more Americans are cutting back on payments to their credit card companies. And the rate at which consumers are falling behind seems to be accelerating. The amount of loans Target wrote off last month rose 2% over the previous month. David Light is managing editor of Consumer Bankruptcy News. He says the credit card issuers are left with few options.
So they're being forced to eat it, really. They're forced to walk away from more than they've been walking away from. The figures for the fourth quarter of 2007 shows that they walked away from over $5 billion.
Target is one of those companies stuck with a lot of deadbeats. Scott Hoyt with MoodysEconomy.com says Target is one of the few retailers to remain in the credit card business.
A lot of major retailers have sold off their portfolios, and actually I think Target's under pressure to do the same thing. But right now they're probably one of the few large ones that still owns their portfolio.
Target has been trying to sell about half of its credit card loans for around $4 billion. But Hoyt says it's a tough market.
It's particularly difficult to finance purchases of debt right now with everything that's going on in the financial markets. So, yeah, it's a difficult time to be a seller.
J.P. Morgan Chase is rumored to be interested in Target's loan business, but this latest write-down news could cause the bank or any potential buyer to negotiate for a cheaper price. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Part of the uptick on Wall Street today was sparked by the dollar. It wasn't much, but with the greenback as weak as it's been, traders are going to jump on just about anything. They'll be keeping an eye on the Federal Reserve, too, when it meets next week. Falling interest rates don't usually do much to keep the dollar strong. So listen, next time you open your closet, you might want to check the labels, because if you've got lots of cheap textiles made in China, hang on to them. Just like food and energy, garment costs are going up. In fact, those costs are going up because of food and energy. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner unravels the cost of clothing.
Apparel makers are facing the same price increases as other manufacturers these days. Rising fuel costs have made it more expensive to operate factories and ship goods. Chinese wages are going up, and the credit crunch doesn't help. But for clothing makers, there's also the rising cost of cotton. Global supply hasn't kept up with demand. In the U.S., cotton production is expected to shrink 20% next season. Alejandro Plastina is an economist with the International Cotton Advisory Committee.
Of course, this is dictated by the expected increase in planted area to other crops which are more lucrative to U.S. cotton farmers, such as soybeans, wheat, and corn.
Soybeans and corn are in demand for biofuels, says Plastina. He also says Wall Street speculators are driving up cotton prices.
Futures prices have been very volatile.
Despite those cost increases, last month clothing prices in the U.S. actually fell. But that's because retailers have been forced to offer discounts in a slow economy. Scott Krugman at the National Retail Federation predicts if anybody takes a hit, it'll be retailers who will be reluctant to pass on higher costs to consumers.
The one way it could impact consumers is if there's less merchandise to choose from, because retailers are being extra cautious with their inventory levels.
But some industry consultants say retailers can only hold out so long. Higher clothing prices may eventually be back in fashion. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The CEO of Baxter International said today the drug company might not resume selling the popular blood-thinning drug heparin in the U.S. market. Heparin was recalled recently after it was linked to potentially fatal allergic reactions. It's another version of the tainted products from China story. The Food and Drug Administration is investigating Baxter's China-based suppliers to see if they intentionally contaminated the drug to increase profits. Product recalls over the past year from pet foods to toys have prompted calls for tighter import inspections. And today, the House considered a new proposal, one that would charge food and drug producers hundreds of millions of dollars to improve product safety. Marketplace's Dan Gratch has more.
The FDA doesn't have the funding to inspect the vast majority of food and drugs imported from foreign countries like China. Congress wants to change that. Democratic Congressman John Dingell is pushing to more than double the FDA's food safety budget. To hire more inspectors, the agency would charge food producers a $2,000 fee. Former FDA attorney Benjamin England represents clients in the food, drug, and medical device industries.
Companies are already struggling with making ends meet, and then companies would have to pay the government in order to come and regulate them.
Most people agree the FDA needs more inspectors, but should the industry pay for it or taxpayers?
It'll either have to be appropriations or user fees, and you know, appropriations are hard to get these days, and user fees have their own problems.
That's William Hubbard, a former FDA deputy commissioner. He says Congress has a bad habit of lowering appropriations shortly after it imposes user fees. After prescription drug user fees were passed in 1992, money destined for food safety inspections was cut back. Hubbard says appropriations are the better option.
We as consumers and taxpayers only pay a penny and a half a day for the FDA. And I think if you polled most Americans, they would say that 2 or 3 cents a day would not be too much to have safe foods and drugs.
Powerful industry lobbies, including local port authorities, seafood importers, and drug makers, have started lining up against the proposed fees. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Microsoft reported first quarter profits today. There is not much joy in Seattle. Earnings at the software company fell 11%. No word, though, from Yahoo about any schadenfreude. New home sales were down again last month to the lowest level in 16 years. That's a pity for the economy's sake, but also because when you move, you wind up getting rid of all the old stuff stuck in closets and attics and garages. And if we're not moving, we're probably not shedding all that excess. Along those lines, there are 2 billion square feet of self-storage space for rent in this country. That's almost 7 square feet for every man, woman, and child, and demand is rising. Andrew Phelps decided to revisit his.
When my dad passed away a few years ago, my mom decided to sell the house I grew up in. Suddenly, there was all this stuff to deal with, and I just could not bring myself to sort through it. So we put it in storage, $40 a month for a 5x5 cube. I promised myself I'd be back in a few months.
27, 12. Oh, it works. Oh my God. That is a lot of crap.
Well, it took more than 3 years, and I finally decided to tackle it.
Star Wars figures. Little umbrella thingies that go in cocktails. More trophies and old baseballs and yearbooks. Oh my God, my Nintendo 64.
I wound up throwing away like 98% of this stuff. I don't know why I kept it in the first place.
I try to tell people that kind of stuff. You know what you're going to do? You're going to be writing checks on this stuff.
Steve Northam is manager here at A1 Self Storage in Oceanside, California. He says most customers are just like me.
You're going to say I'm going to be in there for 6 months or something like that, and I'm going to see you 5 years later, and you're still handing me money. And you've paid more than 3 times what that stuff's worth, in some cases 4 or 5 times.
Americans have stuff, and they can't seem to part with it. The National Self-Storage Association says it's a $220 billion industry, the fastest-growing sector of commercial real estate. It provides business to a slew of mom-and-pop outfits, which make up more than 90% of the industry. Northam says his newest customers are service members facing deployment. Marines make up as much as 25% of his business. That's up from 10% before the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
They come into the barracks, and they put a pallet on the ground, and you stack your stuff on there, and they wrap it up, and then they take it down to a warehouse. You don't have your lock on the door. You don't have 24-hour video surveillance, which we have.
Or air conditioning, or elevators, or the other extras that make self-storage so appealing. Northam says occupancy has always remained above 90% in the 15 years he's worked here. That's because self-storage is big business no matter what the economy looks like. Dave Ratliff is a district manager for the Castor Companies, which operates A1 Self-Storage in 38 locations across California.
A big part of our business in some places recently has been people that are storing temporarily while they stage their home to buy, while they're between houses because they've just moved up. Now we're kind of getting the other side of that, where maybe they're staging their stuff while they move down or while they move out.
Ratliff says the industry's next target, aging baby boomers. The kids are gone, the parents are dying, and it's time to buy a smaller home. That means more crap to put in storage.
We don't like the word crap.
You don't like the word crap. That's
all fabulous stuff. Fabulous stuff.
Sorry. In San Diego, I'm Andrew Phelps for Marketplace.
Coming up, high-flying hedge fund managers prepare for a crash landing.
I speak to them on the phone, and there's a quiver in their voice.
But first, let's do the numbers. Financial services companies drove this up day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials popped up 0.2%, 85 points to close at 12,848. The NASDAQ climbed just shy of 1%, 23 points to end at 2428. The S&P 500 rose 0.6%, 8 points, wrapped up trading at 1388. Merrill Lynch led financial firms higher. It climbed 7% after it said it's not going to cut its dividend. That's kind of a big deal. Citigroup shot up 4.5%. Lehman Brothers finished 6% higher. 3M came unstuck today after the company reported some disappointing earnings. The company's shares slid 1.8%. Markets overseas, well, they were kind of mixed. London's FTSE dropped 0.5%. The French CAC 40, that's the CAC 40, lost 0.3%, while Germany's DAX rose 0.3%. Japan's Nikkei fell 0.25%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The Senate Committee on Armed Services holds a hearing on treatment of detainees. The first World Malaria Day is marked, calling attention to a disease without borders. And the three-day music festival Coachella kicks off in the California desert. Doors open at 11 a.m. No instruments, pets, or stuffed animals allowed. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Congress gave itself some farm bill breathing room today. Lawmakers will have another week to agree to disagree over food stamps, nutrition programs, and subsidies for farmers. The bill already runs $280 billion for 5 years, which means a little something for everyone, including some you might not have thought of. From Washington, Jeremy Hobson reports.
You can't get much farther away from farms than Wall Street, but Sally James at the Cato Institute says it shouldn't be surprising that Wall Street investors are licking their chops over the farm bill.
Farming is not what it used to be. It is no longer just a family farm environment. It's big companies, it's much larger farms run on a much more commercial, cutthroat basis.
For one thing, she says, commodities have become a much more attractive investment as demand has soared. And the subsidies Congress is handing out are making those commodities even more lucrative. Plus, they're making farmers richer. And analysts say that means they'll buy more equipment, fertilizer, and seeds. So Wall Street is eyeing investments in agribusiness, machinery, and biofuels. And Sally James says there's more to the farm bill than subsidies.
The provisions they're putting in the farm bill this time in order to get support for it from the Senate are tax provisions that might be of interest to investors.
One proposal would create a new tax deduction for timber companies. The Wall Street Journal reports that could save paper maker Weyerhaeuser $100 million a year. And the bottom line is whatever gets in the bill is likely to pass because of the Christmas tree of goodies for members right and left.
There's a fairly strong bipartisan support behind this bill, which makes it a little bit different from some others.
President Bush says he's ready to veto the bill without some significant spending cuts, but some here are already starting to doubt that pledge. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Bear Stearns is probably the best-known casualty of the credit crisis. But in the past couple of weeks, a half a dozen hedge funds have gone down the same path, only this time without benefit of a bailout from the Federal Reserve or J.P. Morgan. Multi-billion dollar funds like Peloton and Carlyle Capital have disappeared in not much more than a puff of smoke. And analysts say dozens more could be looking at the same fate. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
June 2006. 4,000 hedge fund managers gathered in the grounds of an English stately home for one of the world's most bizarre business events. The Who topped the bill. The event was called Hedgestock, 2 days of love, peace and networking. These masters of the universe ditched their suits and, wearing caftans and hippie beads, they quaffed champagne, played polo and partied. Analyst Simon Nixon says this was the peak of their pride and extravagance.
People were making dynastic fortunes in the space of a few years, something that, you know, this was something unprecedented, actually, I think, at any time in history. So I think, this, of course, there was a lot of hubris.
Not anymore.
924 spot 345.
The muted atmosphere in this hedge fund dealing room in London tells its own story. The mood has definitely darkened, says hedge fund manager Stephen Bell. No longer brimming with confidence, some masters of the universe are afraid.
It's people in relatively important positions, in important banks, big banks, frightened what might happen. Literally frightened. I speak to them on the phone, and there's a quiver in their voice.
Bell's fund is actually doing well. He avoided mortgage-backed securities like the plague, and he didn't leverage up or borrow heavily, so he's making money for his clients. If he wasn't, he wouldn't be talking to us.
Hello, Peloton Partners.
Hello, is Ron Bella there, please?
He's travelling at the moment. Can I ask where you're calling from?
Yes, it's Steve. None of the hedge fund managers whose funds have blown up in recent weeks were available for comment.
Oh, OK. Can I take your details and get him to give you a call back? He's actually not around at the moment.
Once they bragged about their infinite expertise, grandly demanding 20% performance fees. Now they're lying low. The banks are reluctant to lend them money. Wealthy investors are nervous about their complex trading strategies. Even successful hedges like Stephen Bell admit the bounce has gone out of this business. After 8 months of credit crunch, the mood is wary.
People have adjusted to it, a little bit more accustomed, but, you know, we're still afraid about what might smack us on the side of the head unexpectedly next.
No one is forecasting the end of hedge funds. Fast-moving and flexible, they can make a lot of money, and many still do. Overall, since the credit crunch began, they've done better than mutual funds. But the blow-ups have dented the image of this industry. The name hedge has become a liability. And economist Andrew Hilton thinks the huge performance fees are unlikely to survive.
The fee structure probably won't continue to exist very much longer.
And the name too, you think, might disappear?
The name might well. Try and think of a better name. Multi-directional leveraged fund, MDLF.
Well, I prefer hedge fund.
I'm sorry.
This recently recorded song could turn out to be a financial indicator. It's penned by two hedge fund managers who call themselves the Power Lords. The song is a celebration of the G-string. This could be a sign the swagger is returning to a battered industry.
Hold down your string.
Or it could be just a couple of hedges looking for a new, more lucrative line of work. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, an item we didn't quite get to earlier in the broadcast, Ford is profitable again, at least for the quarter gone by. The company reported an unexpected $100 million profit this morning, mostly, it should be said, on overseas sales. CEO Alan Mulally admitted it's going to be another year at least before Ford's making money all the time. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 85 points, 2/3 of 1%. The Nasdaq added 23 points, just under 1%. The S&P 500 hiked 8.6%. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, are gay bars passé?
I don't think we're quite at the point where the gay clientele is comfortable sitting in a chain restaurant or bar where they can still hold hands or kiss.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.